It's been more than 2 weeks since the Islamophobic terror attacks happened in Christchurch. Since then, the country continues to grapple with a facade that has allowed much of New Zealand to believe this is not us. And yet, many people have pointed out that even before the 15th of March, Islamophobia had long been an issue people were facing. An issue which had many people fearing for their safety, fears that were not taken seriously. A Royal Commission of Inquiry has been announced as a way of investigating whether this atrocious act of targeted violence could have been prevented. One of those voices has been Anjum Rahman of the Islamic Women's Council of New Zealand, who we will be hearing from next week. Anjum had worked alongside the Human Rights Foundation in an attempt to make the government aware of these issues regarding the safety of Muslim people in Aotearoa. The Human Rights Foundation had also worked alongside Muslim communities and government agencies as a means of bridging those relationships. Amro Muhammad was somebody involved in this project.
So my name's Amro Muhammad. I was born and raised in the UK. I'm originally of Egyptian descent. I was born and raised sort of during 9/11 and everything else sort of as a young Muslim in the UK. So I think, experienced a fair share of Islamophobia and that kind of thing, so, you know, I've experienced it firsthand.
Amro's family moved to Aotearoa in search of a better life, he told me.
My parents, my father's a doctor, and he was, he'd been working in the UK for about 30 years, and it was in search of a better life. As a broad reason, he faced a lot of discrimination working within the health services, because of being a foreigner and being Muslim and that kind of thing. We also, as kids, faced it quite heavily because it was, you know, at the time of 9/11 and he had the 7/7 bombings also in London and that kind of thing. So it was quite in your face. It was quite overt. Ranged from, you know, for example, my mother wears a hijab, so it would be, you know, a lot of comments to do with that, you know, call us terrorists and this and bomber and that kind of thing. So a whole range of insults and that kind of thing. So yeah, we moved over to New Zealand sort of in search of a better life, and that's what we experienced as well. So I mean, I can't actually say in my 9 years of being here, I can't really point to a specific incident, you know, of overt, you know, Islamophobia and racism as we sort of experienced in the UK.
So that was it. Yeah. Going to be my next question in terms of how you did find it here. But I guess given that you got involved in this work, which is specifically about that sort of discrimination, how did you find yourself getting into that work? And were you surprised when you did hear the extent of what exists here? Just a bit more background before we hear Amra's answer. Currently, Amra is a solicitor working on Waitangi Tribunal inquiries and other Indigenous and Māori rights issues. He also volunteers for the Human Rights Foundation on a number of projects. One of those was the project mentioned earlier, where Amra and others worked with the Muslim community and with government agencies such as the Security Intelligence Services, Customs and the Police. They called it the Rule of Law Project, and it attempted to address the specific targeting of Muslim people by these surveillance agencies. Back to Amro and his experience of New Zealand.
For myself, I was quite sort of sheltered in that sense. I mean, as soon as I arrived here, I went to law school and that kind of thing. So I would say, you know, I was sheltered from the extent of the discrimination and that kind of thing. Getting involved in it and actually speaking to, you know, communities and people that were, you know, heavily affected by it and were marginalized by it, it was, to me, it was quite eye-opening, you know, that this, while we may not experience it because of being in Auckland, for example, Auckland's quite a multicultural, you know, hub, so you living there, you'd much less experience it than others who are actually, you know, who we encountered, who are living in sparsely populated areas around New Zealand and that kind of thing, and they experience it on a daily basis. So it was quite eye-opening, and it did, and a lot of their experiences actually reflected my own experiences growing up in the UK. So it did definitely brought it home.
Before we get into talking more about that project, I asked Amru what his response was and has been since the 15th of March.
I guess initially it was like abject shock. It was, I think the first news report had come out about 2 p.m. and it said, you know, it had been a shooting at a mosque, and, you know, the information wasn't very extensive. So, I mean, at that point, it was a bit of a, you know, a bit of a shock. It was sort of a bit of disbelief as well. It's almost like, oh, okay, you know, what is this? You know, surely it's not, you know, anything too serious. And then as the news started to flow out and everything else, it was, I think at around 3 p.m., I just completely stopped working. I just couldn't physically work anymore because of the, you know, because of the shock about, you know, and to me, it brought back a lot of trauma from a lot of trauma that was, I guess you could say, buried over the past, you know, 9 years of me being sheltered from this. It brought back a lot of trauma of you know, Islamophobia and all that sort of thing that I'd experienced in the UK. And it was almost like, you know, it was just such a shock to me that, you know, New Zealand is no longer this bubble where we're shielded from, you know, Islamophobia. No, this is, it hit, you know, it just sort of hit to heart that was, you know, that this can, you know, this phenomenon can, you know, can happen anywhere and everywhere around the world, and it's an endemic issue. You know, and I, as you know, as soon as the numbers of the dead, you know, we kept hearing the numbers rising, and there were these everyone talking about a live stream video and that kind of thing. And I think at that point it was just so shocking, because that could have been me. It could have been my brother. It could have been my mother, you know, had the attack took place here. Like, it was you know, the whole aura of New Zealand being a safe haven and that kind of thing was completely destroyed at that moment, I think. Mm. Yeah.
Since then, since it happened, what has been in the news a lot, which is quite significant in its absence of in the news prior to the attacks, but what's come out is that there's been lobbying, basically, by a number of groups to the government to acknowledge that discrimination and hate crimes against Muslims is a real threat, basically. So how do we even, you know, let's try and kind of unpack that. Where do we start there? These voices, one, haven't been listened to. I mean, is that because people didn't take it seriously? They didn't think it was real? Or is it that racism? You know, what's going to happen now that, you know, New Zealand is basically saying that we fucked up?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, and that's a very good way of putting it. In terms of our project, the intelligence services over the past, you could say maybe decade, have received, their legislative powers have expanded to a significant degree to allow them to have the capabilities of spying and you know, and being able to detect threats to public safety. Funding has also increased as well, you know, in that regard. So I guess going back to your point about this being a complete catastrophe, well, yes, it is, because all of these efforts were seemingly all targeted towards the Muslim community. You know, evidence of that is throughout our project, we dealt with a lot of individuals within the community that were directly approached by the services and were goaded into providing information about other members of the community, you know, which actually was... It wasn't a very productive method anyway, regardless of that. It wasn't a very productive method in the sense that it actually created disunity, it created suspicion and that kind of thing. But I think the point of what I'm saying is that all of these efforts were focused on the Muslim community, and it was almost like the intelligence services had completely taken a blind eye to this growing form of, you could call it Nazism or white supremacist movements, white nationalism. And it's not like these movements have been in hiding, and you know, they've been quite vocal in the South Island, which we've seen, you know, there've been a number of rallies and that kind of thing in the past. And even, I mean, just the mosque itself was a target of Islamophobic act in 2016, I believe. There was a pig carcass that was left there and a video made about it. I mean, someone has to be held accountable for this, and it would naturally fall on the shoulders of the intelligence services, whose role it is to protect us and protect our public safety.
So your project, am I correct in saying that that's the one that there's articles that have come out since saying the behaviour or the actions of the SIS actually breached the human rights of New Zealand Muslim people?
I think it was so we were, in terms of these articles, they were talking about specific incidents where members of the community were, they called them sort of coffee sit downs, where they'd take members of the community, sit them down, and they would try to goad them into giving information about other members of the community without actually a lot of the times they wouldn't identify that the intelligence services actually don't have the power to detain, they don't have arrest powers, they don't have any of these powers, you know, and that you are not obliged to sit down and talk to them. So from the accounts of these people that were interviewed, they got the impression that they weren't actually, that they had to attend these sort of interviews and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So that was, in terms of the sort of human rights specter, that was one of the issues. Another issue, which doesn't specifically deal with the intelligence services, but the government agencies on a whole, was the treatment of passengers that would return from overseas, specifically Muslim passengers that would return from overseas and into the various airports here. So there were numerous accounts of people that would be questioned for over 3 hours. They would be denied the opportunity to contact their family members and basically interrogated. You know, there's no other word to, you know, you can use other than that. All in the guise of protecting our public safety, which, as we see from the recent attacks, fortunately, those, you know, the subjects of those interrogations weren't actually posing a threat to New Zealand. There were other elements.
So let's, I guess, go on to those other elements in terms of what's been shown now is that essentially our intelligence agencies weren't looking anywhere near the far right extreme threat. In, I think it said that in 10 years of GCSB and SAS public documents that there's been no mention of right-wing extremist threat. So is this racism? Is this it's a failure, certainly, in what they were supposed to be doing. What happens now?
Whether I would say it was racism would be a bit of a stretch. However, I would call it was prejudicial, of course, in the sense that it did, or discriminatory, in the sense that it did focus specifically on the Muslim community as opposed to, you know, other threats. I would say it was more naive rather than being, you know, tinged of any malice and malicious intent. I mean, I would say it was very naive in the sense that, yes, you know, there has been an incidence of Islamic terrorism in the past decade or two decades and that kind of thing, which I guess would be why they were focusing specifically on the Muslim community. However, there has also been a rise in far-right attacks. You know, and New Zealand is not too dissimilar to the UK, where there are far-right attacks against mosques on a monthly basis. It happens all the time. And New Zealand, as we know now, isn't in some isolated planet. You know, New Zealand is on the planet we call Earth, you know, whereby which shares common characteristics and common factors with other nations. So the intelligence services should have looked at, you know, other examples, for example, the United States as well, where there is, you know, Islamophobia is very rampant and that kind of thing. Just taking the UK, for example, the UK intelligence services, the MI5, actually have an established way back, they've established a unit that specifically looks at far-right extremism, far-right terrorism and that kind of thing. So it's, to answer your question, would I say it's racism? No, I would say it's just pure naivety and there is no excuse for that. You know, there's absolutely no excuse for that.
Extending on that though, because the Islamic Women's Council of New Zealand is also coming up, right, saying that they had tried, they had warned people, they had said that this was an issue. So the work that you guys have done, the work that Human Rights Commission has done, that all of these voices saying this stuff, you know, is that not, how can you kind of just dismiss that? How can these, like, yes, a naivety, of course, and perhaps a slow to move, you know, they've been saying that they have started looking over it in the past few months, but is there not an element of actually not taking this seriously and dismissing these people? Is that's also a problem, right?
Correct, definitely. You know, the idea that the far right are just this powerless movement that, you know, that haven't had much influence since 1945 or something, you know, it's a serious issue that, you know, that perception of the far right, you know, was looked at as being this harmless creature that, while it was repugnant to look at and to listen to, that had absolutely no ability to carry out such crazy attacks. I mean, I think that was, you could say, yeah, but not just naivety, you could also call it negligence as well, you know, this is negligence on behalf of the security intelligence services.
And then dismissing too those Muslim voices who were actually saying we feel at risk.
Yeah, well, I mean, if that being the case, that the Muslim Women's Council contacted them or let them sort of know that there was an incidence of Islamophobia specifically, then yeah, that would be quite, you know, complete oversight from the intelligence services.
You are a lawyer, so you'll know this better than me. But what we have seen, I think, is that there is a little ability to, perhaps not charge isn't the right word, but to hold these particular instances to account. So hate crime, for example, how do we measure that? How do we make consequences for that? If the Islamic Women's Council, for example, is saying this is happening to us, these things, and it's happening to us a lot, we have evidence, but nothing's done about that. Is that because we don't have the legislative powers to do something about that? Does that need to change?
Quite the opposite, no. I mean, there are provisions in the Crimes Act that specifically deal with these incidents of harassment, for example. Assault is one of them. You know, a lot of these incidences, while there is no specific crime called hate crime, there are a lot of crimes that would fall under the ambit of hate crime. So, for example, harassment is one of them, assault as well. A lot of these incidences are, you know, assault or threatening behavior and that kind of thing. So the police do have the power to prosecute people that do this. Mm. Now, I think just drawing on that same issue, when it does come to, for example, harassment online and that kind of thing, then you have the ambit of freedom of speech and freedom of expression, right? So where freedom of expression ceases to become freedom of expression and pushes a boundary is where it promotes and, I guess, propagates violence. In terms of prosecuting individuals that write hateful comments and that kind of thing online, there is a bit of a restriction when it comes to that because of the idea, the principle of freedom of expression, people being able to express themselves insofar as those comments don't incite violence or cause an individual to feel that they are under some severe imminent threat.
So I guess that's where those agencies would then say it's quite difficult to then prove that specific comment incited that particular violence. What are your thoughts on freedom of speech?
Well, I believe freedom of speech is a fundamental right that we all, in a democratic society such as ourselves, we should enjoy just as a fundamental right of being a human being. Now, freedom of speech and freedom of expression should not be completely unfettered, right? There should always be a line drawn. Now, if an individual's expression of their opinion and their speech, for example, crosses a boundary to the degree that it has the effect of you know, causing harm to another individual or a community, or of inciting others to act and to harm others, you know, in that sense, then I believe that that's definitely a firm and a strong line should be drawn there. However, I guess the fear is about limiting freedom of speech is that it limits freedom of speech on the entire. It could, you know, it could erode that freedom on the entire spectrum. You know, we should all have the right to express our opinions in a way that doesn't damage other rights, such as the right to life. The right to life is also a human right. The right to, you know, feel safe, and the right to be able to you know, to have a living, the right to work, the right to, you know, all these other rights. So I guess what I'm trying to say is...
The right to go to the mosque.
The right to go to the mosque, the right to worship, freedom of religion as well. Freedom of religion is another specific right. So I guess, to answer your question, I believe freedom of speech and freedom of expression should be protected to the extent that they do not infringe on our other, the rights that are also enshrined to society. Mm. Yes.
I guess going back to the idea that the internet being a place that you can definitely have your freedom of speech, and often a space, because you can be anonymous on the internet, it's sort of easier to be hateful, I suppose.
Correct.
Also, though, the platform of the internet being one thing, and news media, so mainstream media, being another platform, which has been drawn into the conversation as something that has seen to incite Islamophobia, but also even, I think it was Britain's counter-terrorism chief actually drew a link to mainstream newspapers being something that has led to the radicalization of far-right extremists. So bringing that all together, I suppose, do you consider these platforms, like we've talked about the internet, I suppose, so more perhaps media, do you see that as being something to blame as well?
Yes, 100%. So I guess I could recount a story when I was younger, or a series of stories, I guess, you know, which could be sort of described by one, being a 10-year-old or, you know, an 11-year-old at the time of, you know, when, you know, 9/11 happened and everything else. And just walking into the corner shop and buying my little penny sweets and that kind of thing, and just turning my face and seeing the Sun and the Daily Mirror, you know, these massive newspaper tabloids with just every headline was a picture of a Muslim cleric and something about Muslims need to go, Muslims this, Muslims that. And that in itself is, you know, without someone physically saying anything, that in itself is I guess news media propagated Islamophobia, you know, which made me feel isolated, you know, and it made me feel like I wasn't part of society, and I was the other and that kind of thing. Yes, I believe the news media have a specific responsibility to not incite and propagate these views, and this has been endemic. You know, you've got the Daily Mirror, you've got the Daily Mail, for example. You know, you've got the Fox News and other news outlets which constantly, you know, pump out this kind of rhetoric that, you know, that Islam is to fear, that Muslims are the other, that we should fear, you know.
Well, so I mean, because you have that extreme, right? There's that, yeah. There's the absolute extreme othering. And I guess to bring it closer to home, I don't know if we really do have something like those tabloids here in New Zealand, but we have this sort of the mainstream media, and even our politicians have been called out for inciting xenophobic rhetoric. So even when you look at it on, I guess, a spectrum, we have that extreme hateful messaging, but you also have the kind of casual comments about immigration or about Muslims or about, so that othering process which occurs daily, what about that?
I believe the entire othering process with regards to other nationalities and other races and that kind of thing, you know, those who are not Pakeha, those who are not white European New Zealanders, I believe this is a common cause, you know, that interrelates as well. Because at the end of the day, classifying and classifying Muslims and you know, as being something to fear, as being the other, it's very much parallel with, you know, with the classifying of, say, Asians, you know, and those people as being harming sort of our society and that kind of thing, right? I believe that in light of this recent, you know, horrific incident, that the entire sort of this whole process, as you call, of othering should be addressed. Whereby we don't simply, you know, address the incidents that happen against Muslims, but actually address it on a whole. For example, if you were to look, look at this individual who carried out these horrific attacks, his manifesto, it wasn't specifically targeted against Muslims only. It was targeted against all those non-Anglo-Saxon, you know, white, whatever races. So I guess the point here is that this growing far right, this growing idea of white supremacism does not discriminate between a Muslim and a non-Muslim. You know, it discriminates against all those who are not, you know, who do not fall under this white European ambit. So I believe the cause is collective, and it should be addressed as a collective cause rather than simply the Muslim community, because this attack, in light of these views, this attack could be carried out against other groups as well. These attacks will be carried against, you know, against other groups, not just Muslims. So it's a serious threat.
In terms of talking about white supremacy and I guess acknowledging that the history of white supremacy, even here in Aotearoa, is not new. No. And that, you know, there's the elements of the founding of this country had a white supremacist kind of agenda. So I guess on that point too, this another article I was looking at. So I guess I want to move into talking about representation or lack of representation. So not only in the security agencies are they majority Pakeha, but obviously too mainstream media, majority Pakeha. And this line in I think this article talking about, you know, how much do we actually know about our Muslim communities? How much do we know about these Muslim people in Christchurch? What were they up to? What do they do? What are their lives like? You know, we don't actually know that sort of thing because we don't hear these positive kind of, well, not even positive, but we just don't hear normal everyday life stories about different people in society. We get the mainstream, we get the dominant stories in society. Would you say that that's an issue?
Oh, most definitely. I mean, the fact that we don't hear about, you know, these other communities, and we only sort of hear about what's in the sort of mainstream media, and about sort of predominantly Pakeha, New Zealand European sort of, you know, directed in that sort of sense. Yeah, I think it is a real issue, because what it does is it creates, it fosters the ground for ignorance. It fosters a ground for, you know, for a lack of understanding of the other, which is more often than not the, you know, the foundation for these sort of views. It's where, you know, it's where, you know, one group does not understand the other. Now, had the media been more vocal in portraying, you know, what everyday, you know, Muslims are up to, you know, that Muslims aren't, you know, aren't an alien race, that they are, you know, they are human beings just like everyone else. They go to work, they have children, you know, they have dreams, they aspire, you know, and they cry as well, and they laugh at this, as you know, as with the entire, you know, everyone else in New Zealand. So, I mean, I believe that should, you know, the media have portrayed that side of it, then there would be less of an ignorance of Muslims, of a Muslim community, and there'd be less, I guess, fertile ground for that, those kind of hateful views to grow.
Mm. That idea of, I guess, quote, the unknown, and what that kind of means. And so then we obviously, the othering process again happens, because you want to be strong in the us rather than the them. I probably should wrap it up at some point. So I guess I did want to ask, though, again, given your kind of legal background, in terms of the inquiries that will take place, what would you have them look like? Like, what would a you know, a proper good inquiry look like to you? What does that accountability look like as well?
I believe, you know, a proper inquiry, which is what we require, nothing short of a proper inquiry, should be an exhaustive look at, you know, what the intelligence services have been focused on. Firstly, the focus should be on, A, what expansion of powers and what, you know, and the taxpayers' money that has gone into the intelligence services so far, you know, allowing them to expand their powers and allowing them to you know, to be at access to better resources and that kind of thing. I believe that at that point, once we've established, you know, what powers and everything else that the intelligence services actually have, we should then look at where these powers were focused. Specifically look at documents, memorandum that show where, you know, these intelligence agencies and the apparatus were actually, you know, who they were targeting, what communities they were targeting. I think, you know, it is quite clear who they were targeting, it goes without saying, but, you know, this should be documented, and it should, you know, obviously redacted in this form, that there may be information that would identify individuals and that kind of thing, but should be shown to, you know, the public should be able to see, you know, there should be more, I guess, transparency as to what the services were doing. At that point, there should also be, you know, part of the inquiry should investigate what information the intelligence services were aware of. You know, it should discuss, you know, were there any incidents where individuals raised alarms or concerns about, you know, white supremacy, as we've already heard, but, you know, everything should be on the record in terms of that. We should also identify whether or not, you know, the intelligence services were looking at other countries and, you know, other Western nations that have severe, you know, a severe issue with white supremacism and that kind of thing. That should also be looked at. I guess at the end of the day, individuals with positions of power should inevitably be held accountable, and, you know, the government should take action against these kind of individuals, you know, in the sense that, you know, looking at whether there was a gross negligence on behalf of the intelligence services or not through the inquiry. And should there have been found to be a gross negligence, then serious action should be taken, and not just punitive measures against people that are responsible, but also an initiative going forward such that we prevent these kind of horrific threats to our safety from taking place going forward. That would be, there should be procedures and ways put in place whereby the intelligence services do act on information, whereas it shouldn't only be information about the Muslim community. They should act on all information about all sort of groups that pose a threat to New Zealand. And yeah, there should be more of a, I believe that the intelligence services should take their emphasis less off the Muslim community now that we know that the real threats are not from the Muslim community, and actually focus their threats on other groups.
We're actually talking to Andrew Little tomorrow. If you could, do you have a question that you would ask him? Not to put you on the spot. he's only recently the minister, right? So I mean he has been for the past 2 years, but in terms of the beginnings of, I know, the Islamic Women's Council and those sorts of studies, they were the previous government time. So it's almost as though not only the current government but the previous government should probably be held to account in some way as well.
Most definitely.
My other question though too would be, if it was found, because since, right, the Minister Little has announced that he's given out search warrants, or warrants anyway, of upping the number of people that are currently being surveilled, with the inquiry, hopefully what we will see is whether our agencies did fail, given that they had the powers to prevent it, right? If it's shown to be that they did indeed have the ability to prevent it and they failed to, that's its own issue. But I guess what could be seen is that perhaps they didn't have the powers to do so. Are you concerned that there will be a sort of increase or an exaggeration in the powers given to those agencies? Is that something that we should be worried about?
I believe that the agencies, already from the work that we've done, they have the powers. That is without a doubt that they have the powers. They've had an expansion of powers recently as well. Given that, you know, they have the powers to spy in very broad, you know, very broad methods, you know, in terms of, for example, they have the power not only to assume other identities, but they also have the power to create other entities that are fake entities for the purposes of spying, and they have the equipment and everything else at play. Not only that, is they also are part of the Five Eyes network, you know, which means that they have, you know, access to information from other intelligence services. Now, to answer your question, yes, I would fear, you know, should the intelligence services have a further expansion on that. I don't think the issue here is the expansion of powers in terms of this inquiry. It shouldn't focus on you know, on them not having the powers, but actually more they have the powers now acting on information, you know, and not being, you know, naive or, you know, negligent in the way they were. I guess to go back to your previous question, what question would I have for Andrew Little? Oh, yes. I mean, I would say my first question would be, how, you know, given all these powers, how did the government allow such a catastrophe to take place? And, you know, following on from that question, I would ask him, what are we going to do now to ensure the safety of New Zealanders and of the New Zealand as a whole?
That was Amr Mohammed speaking on the Islamophobic terror attacks that happened in Christchurch more than 2 weeks ago now. Since the attacks, the Human Rights Foundation has created a website where any instances of Islamophobic discrimination can be recorded and reported. Just head to the website, reportislamophobia.nz. As well as this, just remember the 1737 helpline is still available for anyone needing support.